The former, or as he says, extinguished mayor of Christchurch on the panel today. Gary Moore is back with us.
Hello.
Always very welcome to have you with us, Gary. And South Auckland school teacher Steve McCabe.
Good afternoon.
And sometime reviewer as well. Steve McCabe is with us. Good afternoon to you both. And you were okay coming in?
Yes, I made it through.
Because both Herald and Fairfax Online have been mentioning the plight of Robin, the aptly named Robin Waterfall of Portland Road, Remuera in Auckland, Gary. And the road, she's blaming the council for it, for not fixing it, you see. A feeling you'll know well, but the road is
just inundated.
It's just inundated, Portland Road, and she says it's happened three or four times, and I've rung the council. They just give you a reference number, and there are rather dramatic photos online of Portland Road, Remuera. The northern
she
slopes,
should shift
too.
Into, she should shift in by the Avon River anywhere in Christchurch and see what happens there.
Good news for Christchurch. You can expect a few good days ahead, it says.
We've had good days.
The Met Service, yeah. Mm. Western New Zealand, a bit wet. Eastern New Zealand, calm and dry. So, you drove in without incident. Steve?
Got here in one piece, absolutely.
Yeah, nice to see you. And what else have you been... You've had a bit of an epic struggle with an airline, haven't you?
Oh, I've had the most fantastic time with an airline. I mean, we could spend the entire show telling this story. It's that good. And I won't mention the name of the airline, because currently they're doing their bit to try and put this right. But it started a year ago, where my wife and daughter, on their annual trip to the US, they came back and, due to enormous stuff-ups by the airline, missed out on a day in Sydney on the way back.
This is in Florida, because you used to live in Florida.
This is right, yeah. My wife and daughter are both American. They go back once a year to see my mother-in-law. So they came back, didn't get the day in Sydney on the way back through enormous mess-ups. And they came to book their trip for this year, and same airline, that we won't mention for the time being at least, had good fare, good routing, so we booked the tickets, got them booked, and about a week later, Debbie had a look online, looking at our bank account, and she noticed that we hadn't been charged for the tickets. So she called up the airline and said, we are booked for this, right? And said, oh, well, there was a change to the itinerary, so we've cancelled your flight. We said, oh, that's nice. When exactly were you going to let us know? When we get to the airport and we say we've never heard of you? So they said, oh, we'll tell you what, we've got a different itinerary, different schedule. Would you like that? And she said, oh, no, that's a very, very bad routing. We'll pass on that one, thank you. No, we won't take that. Please don't book it. Don't charge us for it. We went ahead and booked with a different airline. 2 weeks later, another quick look at the bank account, and the first airline had, in fact, charged us about $1,900, which we weren't terribly amused with. So Debbie got on the phone first thing in the morning. Instead of getting busy at work, because she works at home, she got on the phone, and they said immediately, the young lady she spoke to said, oh, yes, very definitely, that's a huge mess. We'll have that put right for you within about 2 business days. And she said, no. No, you took it straight away, you'll put it back straight away. They said, no, it takes us a couple of days to put back. We said, no. Every high street retailer in New Zealand can do a reverse of a charge immediately. Why can't you? And they were saying things like they had to send faxes to our... Faxes to our bank. Who sends faxes anymore? But apparently they needed this to do the charge back. And she said, no, you do this immediately. Sort it out. Finally, by the end of the day, they'd put back $1,800. Not $1,900, $1,800.
Well, they're a bit short.
Well, clearly that's where they needed some of our money, yeah. So finally... I did what I do these days in cases like this, and I emailed the CEO of the company and said, you know what, first of all, you're incompetent, and secondly, you're actually bloody criminal at this point. Here's what you're going to do for us. You are going to have to give my wife and daughter complimentary tickets to Sydney for the day in Sydney that they missed last year to make up for this. And they were so apologetic.
They did.
At the end of the day, somebody from the CEO's office phoned up my wife and said, now, how many people in your family? She said, there's three of us. He said, right, you can have three tickets. Where in Australia would you like to go?
18 people in the family.
Yes, yes. including my folks back in England who'll need to be flown down from Manchester. We should have gone there, but we didn't. But no, they've comped us three business class tickets to Melbourne and Sydney at Christmas. But what a fiasco it turned out to be. My wife wasted virtually a day when she should have been working trying to get this money put back in our account. And I mean, we're still getting emails from them saying, there's been a variance on your original reservation. Please let us know, or we'll have to cancel the booking. And we write back and say, for God's sake, cancel the booking, please, before you take any more money out of our account.
That's pretty...
It's absolutely fantastic.
Bizarre. But the long and the short of it is that you now get a free business class trip to Melbourne.
And Sydney. Oh, yes, we're getting both out of it. Oh, yeah. I mean, the guy was saying, anywhere you want to go, fancy Perth? Fancy Adelaide. They're scrambling because I think they realise that, yeah, you simply don't help yourself to nearly $2,000 of the customer's money when they've told you not to. It's kind of fraud.
How odd that they did that.
Mm-hmm.
What a strange sequence of events.
Such is life.
That ended well, but thanks, you suspect, to your belligerence over the, or your perseverance over the phone.
First of all, my wife basically not letting go. She's saying, look, you've admitted that you've fouled up here. Now you need to put it right, and you need to put it right as quickly as you fouled it up. And they just eventually realised that, yes, we really did, and we were a bit embarrassed.
Not Air New Zealand, though. Wasn't Air New Zealand.
No, it wasn't Air New Zealand. Well, yes, although, as long as they still remain a New Zealand company, I'll stand up for them. If they ever get sold off, then that will be a dramatic.
Absolutely.
Okay, Steve McCabe, thank you. Mr. Moore, now you went to TEDx in Christchurch, didn't you?
Yeah.
What was it like?
Fantastic. It's sort of mind food, just for people's to tell people about TEDx. It's a series of either 10 minutes or 18 minute talks, and they just stimulate you beyond belief. It is just the most amazing formula. And I really would like to congratulate Kyla Colburn and her team. They were just great. But there were two young people who would... There was a whole lot of things. It's unfair probably to pick them out. But these two young people, one was Abbas Nazari, who was an Afghan refugee who came to New Zealand in the Tampa. And he told his story, and it was just unbelievable. I've known the boy for years. And the bits he told us were, I cried all my way through it, I'm just hopeless. And then the second one was Joshua Iosifo, who is a Pacific Island student from South Auckland, who's a poet. Now, both of these young men did their talk, and they got a standing ovation because they were just so good. They're both 17. And I thought, I just have a great hope for our future when our young generation are this good. It just fills me full of hope. And there was a woman said to Pam at the afternoon tea break, she said, my God, these kids are so good, I'm going to have to go back and do extra training to try and keep up with them. But these young men were brilliant, and I just want to say thank you to the whole team. And for anybody, you can go onto the TEDx. It's TEDx, EQCHCH, and you can look at the talks from last Saturday.
Now, is this by any chance related to the famous TED Talks from the US?
Yes, yes. And they've worked the formula out in America, and this one is a particularly, this is focused on Christchurch, and there's the wonderful woman that did the Hundi plan, which is she's from Ashburton, and she told us about the $100 of seeds and how a family can feed themselves and all that sort of stuff. It was really good. There was one that I really enjoyed, Ernesto Ciroli, who's obviously Italian, who now lives in America, and he made a point that I'd never thought about. He said entrepreneurs seldom participate in consultation, and they are the people that society do need to be active in our society, and that the plans often bypass them. And isn't that interesting?
Seldom participate in conversation. In consultation.
In consultation. And when you think about it, they're too busy away doing it.
I suppose so. Can you govern like that, though? I mean, it is said that, you know, the ideal form of government is despotism tempered by assassination, but can you... You can't. All right, so you were stimulated.
I certainly was.
Name the airline, say the texters. That's up to our guest, Mr. McCabe, whether he names the airline or not.
Well, put it this way, there's still a few more issues to be ironed out, and I think I'll hold off this time, but if they haven't got things sorted for next time,
oh, you're
in the
using
studio,
this program as blackmail.
Then absolutely, shamelessly.
Leverage.
Yeah, that'll,
leverage.
That's a polite word for blackmail.
The yes. Prime Minister has announced the first share float under the government's partial asset sales program will take place next year. The government will go ahead with the sale of up to 49% of Mighty River Power between March and June 2013. But that's later than expected, because the government had intended the share float to happen late this year. John Key says the delay will allow for further consultation with Māori. Surprised? I'll ask you first, Gary. You can probably, as a politician, see the way this is trending in terms of accommodations that will be made. Is this what you expected?
Oh, this whole thing is an exercise of dogma over financial sanity, really. I'm grateful that we've got patriotic Māori who are actually, they're acting on behalf of all of us, really, in many ways. The whole asset sale thing is just, I mean, I've written an article in our local paper about our assets. There's pressure from the government for us to sell our assets here, and I just think that's just crazy dogma, which I thought had died with the Chicago School of Economics, really.
Apart from the actual rights and wrongs of the sale, Jeff, a texter, says, how sad if Māori compromise their principles and take the money and run, if they are in fact accorded some sorts of rights over water. So this is the thing. I mean, what do you think the end result of this is going to be? Will it be guardianship? Will it be kaitiakitanga? Or will it be a decent dollop of shares from Mighty, a parcel of shares from Mighty River?
Or a mixture of the lot? I just think that Māori were quite happy as long as these were publicly owned. And the principle that they've actually raised, and this is my interpretation, the principle they've actually raised is that they are saying, you sell them, you're selling our heritage, and we have kaitiakitanga.
What's your position on it?
I'm absolutely with Gary on this one. I mean, the word I've got written down in front of me here is also dogma. It seems that for some reason, the national government, John Key in particular, have got some sort of ideological drive that this now has to take place, regardless of what public mood might say. I mean, throughout the history of this, before the election, there was a sense that this was not something that the public supported, whether National got in or not. Generally speaking, the public weren't behind these sales. Since then, there seems to be a groundswell of opinion that says, no, we're not supporting it. And the government is saying, yeah, well, we've got a mandate, so we're going to do it regardless. We've got, I heard, I think it was David Shearer last week on the radio saying, we are close to getting a referendum boxed off on this. He's of the opinion that the referendum will, even though it's going to be non-binding, will go against these sales going ahead. So the government seems to be obsessed with the idea that we have to do it. We're going to do it regardless. And it's becoming almost religious. Mm. Although, here's a possibility for you. We're now, how many months are we into the national government at the moment? We're getting close to a year, aren't we, since the election? And they're still not sold off these assets yet. We don't have the first sale yet. We're now talking about doing this late autumn, possibly early winter of next year. Could it be that Mr. Key is looking for a graceful way of backing down here? If he's going to do it, he might as well just do it. Maybe he's looking for a way of delaying it and maybe trying to wriggle out of it.
Well, if he's doing that, would he have announced a go-ahead today?
Well, he's announced a go-ahead for a very long time from now, which gives him a lot of people a lot of opportunities for it not to make it not happen.
Or it gives him room to manoeuvre, one of the two.
Precisely.
But again, Gary, irrespective of your position on the asset sales, can you afford to back down with an announcement and previous determination of this magnitude? Can you do that as the government in power?
They've staked their fortune on this one. The thing about this is, you know, putting aside my pathological loathing for the whole process, if you look at the world market and you look at the Rio Tintos holding the gun to the head of New Zealand power companies on dropping their prices. If you look at all of those things, you think this is not a time to get a good price. And the basic argument is premised on we will get a good price and we will invest these funds somewhere else. And the rate of return that the government gets on these investments appears to me to be way beyond what they are going to get in savings from the money that they return from the sale. So I just think people respect politicians who say, look, this is what we did think. However, in the light of what the evidence that's come in front of us now, we believe this is the path we should take. I would think that would be really well received.
Right. However you say to begin with, and I absolutely agree with you, that they are taking a dogmatic stance on this, you're then saying that maybe they can review it in a more pragmatic light. And those two things are very, very hard to reconcile.
Mm. Yeah, well, he's pretty nimble. At 21 past four. Well, I mean, politicians are, aren't they? It's not just the current Prime Minister. I mean, politicians are very adept and nimble at these kinds of discussions, no matter what the hardness of the position seems to be.
I can remember one time I was walking down an alleyway and this bloke leapt up from a coffee bar and he grabbed my hand, shook my hand. I know him quite well now. I didn't know him then. He said, "I'm voting for you and I want you to know why." And I said, "Oh, why's that?" And he said, "Because you stood up and said you'd made a mistake. It was an error. You apologised and you changed your mind." He said, "Anyone that can do that's got my vote." Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that was quite a moment.
In the US, that would be decried as flip-flopping. That's one of the, once you state your position out, you have to stick with it, and you don't inconvenient things like facts get in the way.
George Wood's going
It's a bit like the final ruling to a kid that you've got to change.
George Wood's about to join us because we're going to talk about Auckland's Māori Statutory Board, which has set 49... cultural, social, economic, environmental goals as part of its Māori plan for Tāmaki Makaurau. And these are backed by a set of activities that'll give direction, guidance and information to the Auckland Council for developing investment and budget bids in specific areas. This is a wide-ranging document that pushes the Council into new territory, thanks to the Super City setup. It's got a considerable focus on social outcomes, like setting education and health targets. So before George does come on, what do you make of this Māori plan for Auckland, this blueprint for development? I think last time we talked about it, it was costed out at around about $40-odd million a year. Gary Moore, you first. Is this the sort of thing that's best prescribed by an unelected body on a territorial council, or is it best prescribed from Wellington? What do you think?
The former. I haven't seen the list, so I don't really know the full details of what they've recommended. What people have got to realise is that this is a recommendation to the Auckland Council, and it would be no different from a subcommittee of the council making a recommendation to the council, which it either accepts in whole or modifies. And I think with the rich cultural strand through Auckland, vein through Auckland, that's the word I'm looking for, of Māori people, that it is important that they play a really active role, and I think this vehicle is a very good one, and I applaud it, and I think that not everything will be accepted, but if you look at, say, the Manukau Centre, which is, the design of that Manukau Centre, which... you'll know much more about Steve than me. I was really impressed with the Pacific Island cultural sort of theme that goes through it. And it's all those sort of, you change things because you're actually sitting and listening to this culture. And I think it's great.
Okay. Just to break that down for you, the wish list last time, which is essentially the same as Kaitiakitanga. It's wahi tapu, sacred sites and such. It's Māori, life force of ancestral lands and waters. It's rangatiratanga, chiefly authority over resources. It goes on.
I've seen that list, but I don't know the individual.
I don't know been fully specified.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing. And you know, there'll be a bit of give and take by both sides. I think it's a really good. Really good process.
All right, let's bring in, before we hear what Steve wants to say about it, let's bring in North Shore Councillor George Wood, who has called the statutory board's plan pie in the sky. George, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So what is your main gripe with the Māori statutory board? What do you principally object to, George?
Well, it is an independent Māori statutory board. It's not really responsible to anyone. It's not responsible to the council. It's established when the Super City was established in very quick time. And I think a lot of these are very laudable ideas. But for one, it's the council's bedded down its long-term plan for the next 10 years. And then all of a sudden, this plan is foisted upon the council. Now, granted, they did bring something to the council quite some months ago. And there was a to do, and they didn't present it, I don't believe. But now they've come back with this, and I think it's going to be difficult to implement a lot of the stuff which they wanted the council to engage with, because it's really central government responsibilities.
Yeah, that's one of the arguments. Gary, you go on the website, it says right at the top, meet the selected members of the independent Māori Statutory Board. I mean, how independent is it when the members are selected? Because you have an elected bunch of representatives, and you have the co-governance model with self-chosen Māori representatives. Is that a path that you can go down indefinitely?
Well, I don't know how they were selected, and that is quite common within Māoridom. But
sure.
George, my response to you, and greetings to you again. My response to you is that a lot of the stuff could be woven into the council existing plans, and a lot of the kaitiakitanga and the wahi tapu and all that sort of stuff are able to be given to the council staff and said, right, how can we make these happen? I agree with you about some of the educational things, which are central government responsibilities. However, local government does have a responsibility under the Local Government Act for making sure some of these things happen. And a lot of the central government departments have actually forgotten their responsibility to local government to actually deal with them in partnership. And that's where you can be really helpful.
Well, I think, Gary, that it's the atmosphere that we're working in at the present time. I think the Super City Council's very cognizant of the needs of a lot of people, especially in South Auckland, where we have the Southern Initiative, which is a very good program in place and is being developed. But the Independent Māori Statutory Board, I believe they should be working far more closer with the council in developing our plans than coming along with their own very highly developed, their dissertation.
The other aspect of it is that there was already, I think, a 19-strong Māori unit within Auckland City when the statutory board was set up to provide guidance to the Auckland Council. And the argument was advanced strongly at the time, the First Peoples argument. Do you get into trouble, George Wood, with other communities if you have this set up to benefit Māori in Auckland for the next 10 years or so, or even longer, 30 years maybe? Do you get into a problem with Pacific families, Asian families, refugee families, all other sorts of families and communities wanting the same kinds of opportunities?
Yes, I think that's correct. The Pacific people do feel that they're not getting the same amount of attention, and so do the ethnic people and the various groups that under that umbrella who are really wanting more. And when they see the amount of money, $3.2 million a year to operate the Independent Māori Statutory Board, they are really concerned. And I think this is the situation we have. It's a them and us, and not a good atmosphere, as I've said, in which to operate.
Who feels like you on the council, though, do you think? I mean, is yours, to what extent is yours a, how significant is your view, do you think?
I think it's, people are pretty careful as to how what they do say. I'm pretty open and vocal about my concerns. I think that, the Independent Māori Statutory Board could tone down their, position they take. I get on very well with these people, and they're on the individual committees and they attend the committees, and some of them put in a good their views are helpful, but there's others that we don't see very often, and that's the kind of concerns that other councillors have. We have to fight for our positions to get elected, and then we have these people that come along and they're just appointed.
This is the new governance model, you could say, for New Zealand. This is obviously, though, George, the way ahead, and it's been showing signs of being that for a while. It's a bit late to turn that clock back, isn't it?
Well, it is, and, it is. But I think there's no getting away from the fact that Māori are at the bottom of the heap on a lot of the indicators, and they certainly do need a lot more work put into them. And I think the council has got a role and responsibility there. But it's got to be done in a consultative manner.
All right. Thank you, George Wood.
I do think, George, before you go, I think the good thing is you're expressing an opinion. And I think as a result of the debate, things will change. And I think that's both sides. You don't want litany of the deaf. You want actually people listening to each other. And I think you'll get a good outcome. Keep it up.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you.
George Wood on the panel. Your comments, Steve McCabe, before we...
Yeah, just a couple of very quick ones. I mean, first of all, as I think was just mentioned right now, the idea of compulsory lessons in Māori for schools in Auckland, surely that's the domain of the Ministry of Education centrally rather than something that can be imposed just on Māori schools individually. Second, although I have to say, they're talking about doing this from year one, which is something that should be taken on board for all language teaching across the country anyway. But the other thing that comes to mind is a comment that was made by the chairman of the statutory board, David Taupiri. He's making the comment that they're seeking 3% of the council's budget for 10% of the population. And I think comments like that are both disingenuous and somewhat harmful. There's an implication in there that the other 97% of the budget possibly aren't being spent for the benefit of that particular 10% of the population,
correct,
which is patently untrue. Other council spending is done for the benefit of the entire population of the city. And secondly, it fosters, as has been pointed out, this them and us mentality. There are not only two different cultures within the city, or one culture and then several others, but indeed two completely distinct and divorced cultures, which have different needs, different... existences that are completely separate from each other, and is that really the way that we need to be moving forward?
Well, that is the question, but we will consider that question. Well, we've considered that question a number of times on the panel, and we'll no doubt do it again. But because of the big hand is up in 27 minutes to 5 o'clock, we'll proceed. Thank you, Steve, and Gary Moore with us on the panel. Hewitt Humphrey standing by with the news headlines.